Chapter 2. My sister Mary and my best friend, and replacement for Katie, Anne. Mary and I used to wake up in the early morning and watch a televised church service that counted as mass attendance. The broadcast was intended for disabled Catholics. If you were in a wheelchair and couldn't leave your house, you could get credit by watching this. It was called Mass for Shut-ins. When we watched, we'd try to guess how many people would be wearing glasses when they went up to receive Holy Communion. Then we'd watch this Christian claymation show, Davy and Goliath, about a boy and a talking dog. It was made by the same animator who created Gumby. I met my best friend, Anne Rampt, when I was 5 years old. She was 3 and already had to wear glasses. She wore an eye patch to correct a lazy eye, too. When I first saw her, she was rocking back and forth in her crib to relax herself. I jumped in the crib next to her and started imitating her rock. From that moment on, we were inseparable. Her parents were on the road to divorce, and she had 3 older siblings. Since I had lost my little sister, Anne was an instant replacement. My dad always said, Anne took over Katie's role. Anne and I would cut out JCPenney models from catalogs and make paper doll families, and we'd play with Barbie dolls. We would make up elaborate Catholic scenarios for the Barbies. I would build big churches and confessionals for them. And after I got a Stretch Armstrong for Christmas, I made him the big, muscular, sexy priest they would have to confess their sins to. Oh, Father, Father, please forgive me, for I have sinned. Pray for forgiveness, he'd say, protecting them. The two of us lived in our own explosive, magical world of playing house and making up stories and doing characters and voices. We were always working on impersonations of people we knew, honing accents. We would spend the whole day talking in one character's voice. We'd be Mr. Rossi, a friend's Italian father, or Anne's grandmother who had this great Southern Ohio accent, so country. Now you two girls go wash yourselves up while I get the blueberry pie out of the oven. Talking in character would go on all day. Anne was so good at imitating people, not just their voices, but their mannerisms. Her impressions of people were superb. It was so fun and natural. We could do it endlessly until finally we would have to force ourselves to break character, saying, okay, we've got to stop. As Anne remembers it, we would play act everything. Our houses were 15 minutes from school, but it would take us a half hour to get home. Why? Because I was doing imitations of every single person I'd seen that day. Anne once said everything was play. We'd play school, we'd play hospital, we played Barbies until we were 20 years old. We also played this board game called Mother's Helper. My dad loved that game because it would tell us things like, please clean the bathtub in the bathroom, and we'd run and have to go do it. We didn't go to camp. On summer days, we would just do other crazy stuff, like wake up super early, ride bikes, swim, and just excessively exercise all day long. Or take the rapid transit to the airport and watch people say hello and goodbye. We just felt life open up when we did things like that. The best was taking the bus to the hospital to eat lunch in the cafeteria and be around the doctors. We liked to act like we were part of the hospital staff, too. I love being in a new atmosphere, getting a tuna fish sandwich with all the doctors in scrubs and clogs, and whispering to Anne, that doctor was just performing surgery on someone. It was inspiring. It's always good to change things up. I think that's true for anybody. And that's what hospital cafeterias were for Anne and me. If you ever feel stuck, just go into a completely different atmosphere with different kinds of people and see how stimulating it is. There's nothing better. Anne had a hard time in school. Though she was so bright, she just didn't like it. But she was an unbelievable storyteller who would remember everything anyone told her. As we got older, we got really into Robert Altman movies like Nashville and Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. Anne was the first person who ever said she could imagine me being in the movies. Watching Karen Black singing Sincerely, she said, I could picture you with a Southern accent, like doing that. I said, you really could? Yeah. She gave me so much confidence. We love the whole Southern universe. Anne wanted to be a country singer like Emmylou Harris and live in Nashville, but she was nervous about getting up in front of people and performing. When we were in high school, she asked me, can I practice my singing for you? I really do want to. I said, okay. But then she wouldn't let me look at her. She turned her back and started to sing, but she never turned around and faced me. She only wanted me to listen. And when she was finished, she wanted to know if I thought it was good. And it was good. Anne, my sister Mary, and I went to a Catholic school called St. Dominic's from first through eighth grade. When anyone asked Sister Christina, my first grade teacher, for a hall pass, she'd say, "Do you want to smell it?" It didn't make any sense, but it was her way of warning us that if we misbehaved, we would get whacked. I thought, Sister Christina is not a happy nun. I wonder what her hair looks like underneath that veil. Is it long or short? I was so curious. And it was strange that such a beautiful young woman was dressed in drab nun garb. But we would get extra credit at St. Dominic's if we went to the convent after school and prayed with the sisters. So I thought, I'm going to go pray with those nuns. Mostly, I wanted to see where they lived. When I visited the convent after school, I thought, looking around, this is so weird. The living room is so plain. It looked like rented nun furniture. Then Sister Christina asked me, "Do you want some pep juice?" and poured Tang into little tiny Dixie cups. I drank my pep juice as we kneeled down and prayed in her church basement. What an interesting life for a young woman, I thought. Devoting her life to God, or married to God. She fascinated me. Years later, Sister Christina was spotted in a miniskirt with one of the boys' dads from school. He was driving a golf cart and she was riding along with him, whooping it up. I was so happy to hear that she'd taken off her veil and left the convent. She was free! My interest in performing really took off in first grade when these professional choreographers, Miss Patty and Miss Jackie, who were also sisters, not nuns, came to St. Dominic's and taught each grade an Irish musical number with singing and dancing for the big St. Patrick's Day school show. "Okay, 5, 6, 7, 8, they said and led us through our dance routine. I realized these ladies were real professional dancers, and I'd never seen that before. St. Dominic's school did not have a big budget for theater, but on St. Patrick's Day, we would get costumes, prairie dresses and green vests, and put on a big show. Miss Patty and Miss Jackie had jet black hair, bright red lipstick, and wore red spandex pants. I wind up partially basing one of my SNL characters, Sally O'Malley, on them. The head priest at St. Dominic's was Father Gallagher, so for the finale, all the grades sang, "G-A-L-L-A-G-H-E-R spells Gallagher. Proud of all the Irish that is in me." And I thought, oh, I love this. Wow. It was so exciting. It was always the highlight of my school year. Each grade had their own individual song and dance number. On the night of the show, all the mothers showed up in the classroom to do the girls' makeup. They set up little stands. I love the smell of the lipstick and the feeling of anticipation as I waited in line for a mother to do my makeup. I also had good instincts about show business and was very savvy about figuring out who was the best mom makeup artist. I thought, her makeup's not that good. She's not doing a good job. Now that mom, she's the best. Yeah, I'm going to go to her. And I would tell my friends who to go to. All the parents came to see us perform in the evening. It was a very special night, but I also couldn't fully enjoy it because St. Patrick's Day was also a big drinking day for my dad. He would go downtown to the parade and then hit the bars. That morning before he left, I told him, "You're not allowed to pick me up in the classroom after the show. I'll just meet you outside on the street, okay? Don't come to the classroom." I worried all day. Oh, God, I hope he's not smashed. I hope he's not drunk. I would pray that he would come home first, take a little nap, have a little coffee, sober up so he would not be too drunk for the show. I didn't want him to come to my classroom and embarrass me. Worry and hope. But when I was on stage, I could tell by the way he was waving how drunk he was, slurring out to whoever was next to him, "That's my Molly!" One time midway through the school year, our lunch cards ran out of punches. When I brought up my tray, one of the cafeteria ladies told me, "We'll let you get this one hot lunch for the day, but your card is out and your dad needs to pay for a new one." I was so worried that my sister Mary was going to have to go without food, so I crumbled up a hot dog in my pocket and went out to find her on the playground. Then I pulled the hot dog out of my pocket and held it out to her. She said, "It's okay, Molly. Someone already gave me a punch on their card, so I already ate, but that's so sweet. Thank you." We always looked out for each other. At St. Dominic's, I was elected president of my class 2 years in a row. My mother was right about my ability to make friends. I was popular. The main reason for this was that I never wanted anyone to feel the way I did, left out, forgotten, not included, so I was good to everyone. At recess, we played a game called Family. My friend Amy Wall and I were always the moms, and we drafted kids into our families. We would line up the kids on the pavement and pick families. She'd pick a kid, I'd pick a kid, she'd pick a kid, back and forth until there were no more kids. Everyone begged to be in my family because I was always the best mother, the fun mother. I made sure my family was always happy and my kids could fly. We played Family almost every recess near the vestibule. I would fly and my kids would follow me up into the sky and all around the parking lot. It was a perfect fantasy. I was the mother. I wanted to be the best mother. Then in fifth grade, this angry boy named Billy Fox passed me a note that said, "Ha ha, you don't have a mother." I had hardly ever cried before about my mom, but I broke down in front of my classmates. I just lost it. It ripped me out of my fantasy. I remember thinking, I do have a mother. Yes, I do. And she loves me. Okay, she's not here and she can't pick me up from school like all your mothers because she's in heaven, but I have a mother. I wanted to get him to understand. But really, I was thinking, oh no, he's probably right. She is dead. It was a very profound and dramatic moment, the first time anybody punctured my fantasy. The principal called my dad about the incident. That night, my dad asked me if I wanted to talk about my feelings. I mumbled something like, no, that's okay, because I was tough. When you lose a parent, you don't want anybody to treat you differently. You want to just blend in. At that point, I didn't want anybody to bring it up. I was just embarrassed about the whole thing. But it made me realize how vulnerable I really was. Chapter 3. My dad, Mama Rose to my Gypsy Rose. James Francis Shannon was the youngest of 10 kids and used to provoke all his sisters, Aunt Bernie and another 6, and all their friends, too. They'd be in fancy dresses shouting, "Jimmy Shannon, don't you dare spray me with that hose!" And then he would spray them. He was bad, and they loved him. All women did. He was boyish, and he was a troublemaker, a mischievous kid who grew up to become a dapper young man. He dressed up to go to the 5 and dime store. He would buy a movie magazine and sit at the counter with his root beer float flipping through the pages, looking at all his favorite movie stars. He had always wanted to be an actor and perform at the Cleveland Playhouse, but said he didn't have the confidence. And yet he was wild. Once his dog bit him and he bit his dog back. That kind of guy. My dad cared about style. He wore ascots, cashmere coats, vests. I saw him as a real rebel and radical thinker who didn't want to play by the rules. We used to go to amusement parks a lot. Once, he took Ann Rampton and me, paid for himself, and made us sneak in. He didn't want to pay for us, so he said, "Just sneak around to the far side of the park where no one can see you and hop over the barbed wire fence." It was like a test. We were little kids, too, and he was proud of us for making it through. Though we were covered in scratches from the barbed wire, it was exhilarating. At the mall, to make us kids laugh, my dad undressed the mannequins and threw their wigs on the floor or ripped their shirts open and pulled their pants down. He was silly and mischievous. On one occasion, he adjusted one's hand so it was cupping the other one's plastic boob. Anne said, "Oh my God, your dad is so funny." We were still little kids. Another time we went to see a movie at a mall after hours. He encouraged us to grab a bunch of wigs from a closed wig store. There was a big metal fence blocking the entrance, and my dad said, "See if you can stick your little hands in and steal one." We had little wrists so we could stick our hands through and pull out wig after wig, laughing hysterically. We wore the wigs out of the mall, cracking up. I remember asking him, "What do you think of that girl's father?" And instead of answering, he would make a noise and draw a big question mark in the air like, "The jury is out." It was funny. And though my dad was super charismatic, he could just switch if something set him off and lose his temper. One time, Anne and Mary and I were shopping with him at the lollipop shop where we bought our school clothes. He liked to get a deal and was picking things from the sale rack. We went up to the front to pay for our items, and this young girl at the register said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, this stuff is not on sale." My dad said, "But I got it from the sale rack." The owner, an older woman, came over and said, "No, It's not on sale. He was indignant for a moment, and then he just flew into a rage. He shouted, God damn it, then that is false advertising. Anne and Mary and I just looked at each other like, oh no, here he goes. We knew we couldn't control him. He marched back to the sales rack, looked at the sales sign and said, really? And slid all the hangers in the clothes off the rack and down onto the floor. Then he shouted, this is false advertising. He moved on to the next rack and did the same thing. And this is false advertising. He shoved both the racks over, crash, and shouted, come on, girls, let's go. As we were leaving, without buying any clothes, he yelled at the manager, and you're fat, you're fat, you're fat. We were all shocked. Anne just whispered, oh no, which is what we were all thinking. As the door was shutting, my dad hissed at the clerk, and fix your teeth. He would always hurl one last insult and was always about appearance. To say he had a temper is putting it mildly. He could be mean like Jack Nicholson's character in Chinatown, delivering lines that both cut down and confuse people, like, you're dumber than you think I think you are. I never knew what could set him off until it was too late. One time, Mary and I were with him at the end of a long day at the amusement park in a crowded tram on the way to the parking lot. He was smoking, and a woman said, sir, can you please move away with your cigarette? He replied, can you move your fat ass? Because if you didn't take up so much space with your fat ass, he waved a cigarette. You know, maybe you wouldn't get stuck in my smoke. So I either adored my dad or was frustrated and at the end of my rope. There was a lot of back and forth. I never knew which dad I would get, the one who met my needs or the one who couldn't. I'd be frustrated by him. I'd be angry with him. And then he would understand me and we would be so simpatico and so in sync and have so much fun till along came another moment of total disconnect and I felt so alone and abandoned. When Mary and I were little, we were completely reliant on him to be taken care of, to be fed. Our survival depended on him, so it was terrifying when he would fly into his rages or, even worse, descend into silence, ignoring us. We lived in a two-family house in Shaker Heights. The top two floors in the basement were ours, and the ground floor was rented out. One afternoon, we heard him coming upstairs, his heels clicking one step at a time. He came through the kitchen door, looked around, and didn't say hello. He didn't say anything. He just gave us a silent treatment. He was mad about something. We knew the drill, so we would immediately start cleaning. I don't remember what we'd overlooked that first time. Maybe Mary hadn't taken out the trash, or I hadn't vacuumed the dining room. Who knew? But it was enough to ignore us. We had to figure out what it was. This got to be a habit. He'd just come in and ignore us, sometimes for as much as a whole day. Or he'd be nice to one of us and ignore the other one, playing us against each other. We would ask him, Daddy, are you mad? So from then on, when we got home from school, we would just start cleaning, trying to second guess what he might look for. He would give us the silent treatment until we had fixed what we had done wrong, and then he would talk to us again. That was the pattern. Whenever we heard him pull up into the driveway, we'd think, uh-oh, and hop to it. My dad was very much responsible for making me who I am. He gave me a lot of confidence. He was like the mama rose to my gypsy rose. He really believed in me and understood me and gave me great advice. Like, listen, if you don't have a good time at a party, it's your own fault. You need to go over and introduce yourself to the person who doesn't have anyone to talk to. You need to extend yourself and go ask them questions. Take an interest. Molly, you're naturally good at that because you're so interested in people, and that's why you have a lot of friends, which was the same thing my mother had noticed about me. But then he could flip. One time, my friend Allison Earle and I were downtown at Higby's department store shopping, having fun. My dad loved Allison. She was easygoing, feminine, classically beautiful with her long, light brown hair, and silly. I met her in third grade, and she remembers that I was the only one from the class who invited her over for a playdate, and that we put crepe paper in puddles to turn them colors. She laughed a lot with my dad. They clicked, and he was more permissive when I was with her because of how much she liked him and he liked her. Still, I needed to find a payphone, call home, and find out if he was okay. I always had to be checking in. This time, however, I only called once. Allison and I did some more shopping and bought some jelly beans, and I took the rapid transit home. It was 5 o'clock, not too late, when I walked in. My dad was sitting in this red and white velvet armchair, waiting, stewing, in a rage. He looked up at me and shouted, "You have been downtown not even thinking about me. You only think of yourself. You are monumentally selfish. How dare you? Even though I hadn't done anything wrong, even though I had already called him from downtown, I started to apologize. I'm so sorry. No. And I tried to explain myself. I didn't mean to. Of course I think about you. He repeated, "You are monumentally selfish." Then I ran up to my room and bawled my eyes out. After a while, he came upstairs and said, "Molly, I'm so sorry. I worship you. Don't you know? I'm so sorry. I worship the ground you walk on." I replied tearfully, "I love you. I love you. Don't you know how much I love you? I love you. Of course I was thinking about you. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm always causing you so much pain. And I'm sorry I make your life so miserable." "No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry," he said, and he got down on his knees. "Please forgive me." Allison said I never told her about these blowouts. I always told Anne everything. She understood. But sometimes my dad could be jealous of her because she was my closest friend. He felt threatened. If I wanted to play with Anne, there was a ritual I had to follow, even if he was in a good mood. We would sit down at the kitchen table and we would talk with him for 45 minutes to an hour to make sure he was okay. Kind of telling stories, entertaining him, being silly with him. So that was the good scenario. Him at the kitchen table, Anne there too. All hail to the king. We put in the time, laughing and having fun, and then we could go play. And all the while I'm thinking, can't you just enjoy that I'm with my friend and you get a little break? But again, that was the good scenario. The nightmare scenario, if he was in a bad mood, was that he would just blindside me. If he knew I wanted to go play with Anne, he would pick a giant fight on some other topic before I even got out of the house to go meet her. He just became crazy with jealousy. He was afraid of abandonment, and when he was afraid he might be abandoned, he made my life hell. It almost was too much of a hassle to make plans to hang out with her. In these moments, it was just me and him, and I would experience what felt like a blackout. We'd be in the den alone, he'd be screaming, and the whole world would contract to just us, with me crying, pleading, spinning in darkness, trying to respond to some irrational accusation, trying to get him to understand me, but unable to get through. During these fights, with my heart pounding, I could feel my brain dropping down like an elevator I was locked inside and I couldn't get away. The arguing would pummel me into a black depression. I was in a panic, pleading for him to understand me. I was fighting for my life, and I'd be getting tunnel vision. One time as he screamed, the whole world contracted to just the objects on his desk. I wouldn't even want to play after one of these blind sightings. Then when I was released to go see Anne, she would have to calm me down because I'd be so angry and upset. "I hate him, I hate him, I hate him," I'd cry. She'd listen to me. She'd comfort me as I sobbed. Even if I went on for an hour, she was like a little therapist. One time we climbed to the top of a hill with a beautiful view, and I cried and cried as Anne just said, "I understand. I'm sorry." She was maternal and patient. She waited until I got it all out, and then we would go play. Anne knew the drill. And it wasn't long before the cycle happened again. There was always so much drama. A lot of my childhood was spent listening to my dad talking about how he had lost his wife. Not how we had lost our mom, how he had lost his wife. And yet my dad also gave me a kind of freedom few other girls had. As a young girl, there was no pressure to act ladylike. I could just be completely myself, like Pippi Longstocking. I wore whatever I wanted to wear, red and blue tights in the summertime and shorts with patent leather party shoes and bobby socks. When I had holes in my kids, my dad would say, "That's good, Molly. That shows you have character. It shows that the shoes have been worn." My dad really let me be myself. It gave me so much freedom later as a performer. Another benefit or consequence of his anything-goes attitude was that I didn't take many baths. Because our bathroom was on the third floor of our house, it was too much for him to walk up the steps with the brace on his leg. So I also had a dirty neck. Very dirty. I remember I used to sleep over at my friend Amy Wall's house all the time, and one of her sisters, Maureen, shouted, "Molly Shannon, your neck is filthy!" And it was so dirty. Black. I had a black neck because I hadn't taken a bath. Whoa, she's right, I thought. I hadn't even noticed. The Walls were a family that did normal things, like bathe. Amy's mother would make dinner every night. There were four girls in the family, and one time in front of all of them, Mrs. Wall said, "I'm going to make chicken cacciatore for dinner tonight." And I said, "I'll have a chicken, but I don't want any of the cacciatore." The whole family really laughed. I knew before I said it that it might be funny, so I tried it out. That was the first time I made a whole group of people laugh, and I loved it. Another time, I went to basketball practice in a pantsuit. It was a plaid pantsuit with a matching vest, and I brought it to school in a brown grocery bag. I pulled my plaid pantsuit from my brown paper bag in the locker room, put it on, and I was ready to play ball. These other girls whose moms had dressed them started snickering, "I like your pantsuit." A couple were even whispering, "Oh my God, she's the queerest." But there I was, playing basketball in my plaid pantsuit, and my dad didn't care. He encouraged me to be an original, so I didn't care. I always knew that I could do whatever I wanted in certain ways, because next to me was a person who would defend me and be there for me. He even gave me insults to hurl at people. If somebody said something mean to me in the lunch line at school, he would ask, "What did that kid say to you?" And then he would suggest a comeback. He was the total opposite of the kind of parents you'd see today. One time he told me to say to an obnoxious boy, "If you had a brain in your head, you'd be lonesome." I thought, what does that even mean? If you had a brain in your head, you'd be lonesome. It was kind of like an old-timey insult, like something the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz would say. I liked the Scarecrow, but I never did use that insult. My dad also turned to me for advice. This started around age 12. "Molly," he'd say, holding up some letter or contract or bill, "what should I do about this? And what about this? Could you read this? You're so logical, Molly, and you understand." I'd look at financial documents and he'd be really, really appreciative and talk to me like an equal. I was like a little adult. "You're so smart, Molly. Can you help me figure out these papers? You're so wise and logical." It gave me all this pride. I felt like I was a little queen. He made me feel like, wow, I can do anything. "Take your time reading that," he'd say, "because I get so nervous that I'm going to make a mistake." I thought, wow, I must be very capable because he's put his trust in me to solve these adult problems. It was great for my self-esteem. He validated me and made me feel smart and super competent. But then he would just turn and not take my feelings into account at all. Since my dad had the role of both mother and father, he sometimes was overwhelmed. I see this even more being a parent now and wondering how he possibly did it all by himself. He was 24/7 with two little girls. There was no wife. He had no help. He had to pick us up from school, keep the house clean, take us to piano, cook us dinner, make money. He didn't have a day job, but was managing rental properties and appraising houses to make ends meet all by himself. It was a lot for a single man, so sometimes he would take a little speed. He'd say, "I gotta catch up," and pop some Dexamil. It was the perfect combination of an amphetamine and a tranquilizer, and he would begin deep cleaning the whole house. My sister and I would go to school, come home, and he'd still be cleaning. He'd be cleaning, 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 cleaning all day. Dinners with my dad were usually fun. He cooked food in plastic bags he heated in boiling water. This was before microwaves. It was all Stouffer's, cream chip beef on toast or roast beef and potatoes. As we ate, we would watch Three's Company and have delicious Fruit Loops for dessert. But on cleaning nights, he just kept on cleaning, and we had to look after ourselves. Once after one of his all-night sprees, as the sun was rising the next morning, Mary came into my room distraught. "Daddy's still downstairs, cleaning!" When we went down to the basement, we found him doing laundry, sucking on a cigarette, and itching his arm, just like a speed freak. But the house was sparkling clean. "Girls," he said, "if you want to eat, just eat on the floor and don't get crumbs on the ground." So we all sat in a little circle and said our prayers on the floor. "Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits us here, ever this day be at our side to light and guard, to rule and guide. Amen. God bless Mommy and Katie and Fran." Then we ate on the floor and didn't get crumbs anywhere. And when the house was finally done, he played Judy Garland music. My dad loved Judy Garland. "Swanee, How I Love Ya, How I Love Ya." And everything was perfect. From then on, "Swanee" meant the house was sparkling clean. This was a regular occurrence. My dad would get behind, feel stressed out, pop a Dexamil. We called them cleaning pills. Chapter 4. Hopping the Plane. One summer morning when I was 13 and Anne was 11, we were sitting at the breakfast room table with my dad and talking about dares. He thought stowing away on a commercial jet, hopping a plane, would be the greatest possible stunt. We said, one day we're going to hop a plane. We were full of bravado. He shot back, well, good luck with that. I dare you. Anne lived two blocks away, so we went and told her brother Tom, too. He said, you guys can never do that. It sounded like a challenge to us. Oh, yes, we will, we said. This was when flying was really easy and you didn't need a boarding pass to get through security. We kept talking about the plan, and a few weeks later, on a summer day, we decided we were going to try it. We put on ballet outfits and put our hair in buns. We looked really innocent. Our thinking was, if hopping on the plane ended up not working out for some reason, we would just go take a ballet class instead. That was our backup plan. I wasn't that interested in dance, but I just loved the pulled back hair and the pink leotards, the way the Capizio ballet shoes smelled, and pretending that I was a prim and proper little ballet dancer. For me, a ballerina was a character I was playing. My sister Mary was a fantastic figure skater. She really got into it, doing very competitive figure skating in junior high and carrying on into high school. She was a beautiful skater, so athletic and graceful, meeting up with her coach and practicing all the time. I loved inhabiting the whole world of ballet more than I love the actual dancing. Mr. Martin, our teacher, who was English and very proper, would say humiliating stuff to me in his snotty, affected accent while explaining how to position my feet. Molly, pretend like you are cutting a pie as I can see you fancy eating. We took a train from Shaker Heights all the way to Cleveland Hopkins Airport, more than 20 miles, which was already a huge thrill. All we had was a plastic bag with a change of clothes and a few dollars in it. When we got there, Anne asked me, where do you think we should go? I hadn't even thought ahead far enough to pick a destination. Let's see, there's a flight to San Francisco, Anne said. But there was one leaving earlier for New York. So I just took the reins and decided, let's go to New York! We walked straight to the gate, and there was hardly anyone waiting to get on the flight, so I came up with a plan. I went up to the stewardess, and I really innocently said, hi, would it be okay if we just go on the plane really fast so we can say goodbye to our sister? She said, sure. She bought it. So we skipped down the runway and took two seats near the very back and ducked our heads down. We were so excited. We were savvy, tricky little operators. I expected the stewardess to come find us, but she forgot we were on the plane. She was up at the front explaining to everyone how the seatbelts worked. We started to realize that the plane was maybe going to take off, was actually going to take off with us on it. We held hands and started to pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother God, pray for sinners now at the hour of our death. Amen. We started to pray faster and faster. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother God, pray for sinners now at the hour of our death. Amen. Holding hands tighter, tighter, tighter as it sped down the runway. And then we heard zzz, and the plane took off. It was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, we're in the air, we're in the sky, we're in the fucking air. We kept saying our Hail Marys until the plane leveled out. Then we began to relax a bit and forgot about the stewardess till she started going around taking drink orders. When she stopped in front of us, her face turned ghost white. You could see 100 thoughts swirling around up there. She looked like she was actually going to pass out, like her eyes were starting to roll back in her head. But she didn't say anything. She just collected herself, patted the front of her uniform, and said every word super controlled. Can I get you ladies something to drink? While the look on her face said, oh, motherfucker, what the fuck did I do? I'll have a Coke and peanuts, I answered, trying to sound really confident. Anne asked for the same. The stewardess went and brought us our order, and we just couldn't believe it. The flight wasn't that long, but we were clenching our fists. We thought we were going to get busted when the plane landed. We walked to the front, shaking in our boots, but the same stewardess who'd let us on in the first place just smiled and said, bye, ladies. Have a nice trip. Like a chicken with its head cut off, she looked frozen in fear outside of her body. We were flabbergasted. But I guess it makes sense. I think she was afraid that she would get fired. Two minors, no parent, no ticket. She just let it go. She made the decision not to say a word. She looked petrified. Then we were in New York City. It was a really long walk, about 45 minutes from the airport to the subway. We didn't know anything, so we just asked strangers how to get to places, and they would say, okay, you know, you take this train, you take that train. We picked Rockefeller Center as our first destination. I'd heard about it on TV and in the movies. We snuck onto the subway, just sprinted under the turnstiles, and then we were there. I remember saying, this is the best, over and over. We went into a diner for grilled cheese and tomato soup, dined and dashed, saying, see you later, as we skipped away down the street without paying. We ended up going into tourist stores and stealing I Love New York t-shirts. We just looked really sweet and innocent in our ballet outfits. We had our hair pulled back in buns. We were like two little con artists on a crime spree in New York City. Eventually, I found a payphone and called my dad. We made it to New York, I said triumphantly. What? Oh my God. He couldn't believe it, but he also couldn't really be mad because we had told him we were going to try and he had egged us on. He was definitely worried, but he was also kind of excited because he liked crazy stuff. He said, oh gosh, I don't want you wandering on the streets. What, can you go find a hotel that you can stay in and then maybe Mary and I will drive to New York City and meet you? Then my dad called his friend Jolene Ramft, Anne's mom, and told her that her daughter was in New York City, and Mrs. Ramft immediately broke out in multiple cold sores. The rest of the afternoon was taken up with him calling hotels to see if they were willing to let us check into a room till he got there, or wait in the lobby, and hotels saying no and kicking us out. They didn't want to be responsible for babysitting. None of them would let us stay. They wanted an adult with a credit card. So we had to go back out and keep walking around. We had a full day of magical New York City fun until the sun went down. Eventually, I called my dad from 42nd Street, and he said, all right, you got to come back home now, but I'm not paying for it, so try to hop on a plane back. So we returned to LaGuardia, and when we attempted to repeat our little scam, we kept getting caught. It was easy getting onto the plane earlier from Cleveland, but then on the way back, the airport was crowded. The flight we tried was packed, and as we moved from row to row, people kept coming up puzzled and saying, I'm sorry, but I think this is my seat. We gave up and called my dad from the airport, so he ended up getting us real tickets home. When we got back, he and Mary picked us up. He was very happy that we did it. It was like a celebration, but he was also annoyed at having to buy our tickets. He said we had to pay him back with our babysitting money, and he didn't let up on the agreement. He really did keep track of my babysitting money and took a big cut for a long time. A few years ago, someone asked me what lesson I learned from hopping the plane. I said, the lesson I learned is that I could get what I want with a break the rules, everything is an adventure, people are mostly good mentality. The world seemed open to me, and it was the greatest day ever. Chapter 5, Love and Drunks. In a way, my dad did have a partner in Bill O'Neill, his best friend, and one of the kindest, gentlest, and most thoughtful adults in our lives. They met in 8th grade. Other boys were calling Mr. O'Neill a wimp and a sissy, and my dad stood up and defended him. They were both smart men with very similar senses of humor, but they were also opposites. My dad was outgoing, whereas Mr. O'Neill was reserved. My dad was slim, and Mr. O'Neill was heavyset. We went to the movies together. We took our vacations together. When we went out to fancy restaurants on vacation, places with live piano music, my dad would usually dance with me and Mr. O'Neill would dance with Mary. My sister was happy with this arrangement. She adored Mr. O'Neill, and Mr. O'Neill loved her. Like our dad and Mr. O'Neill, my sister thought we were also opposites. Mary described us as night and day personality-wise. But Mary was also funny and an athlete, whip smart, and so, so thoughtful, with a really excellent eye for interior design. People said we both spoke the same way, lots of energy and fast, really fast, and had the same mannerisms. At night, we would tickle one another's backs. But when we were kids, Mary didn't realize that the accident had bothered me, because I seemed to go on without a care. Only as we got older did she realize that we just dealt with it differently. Also, and this is kind of off topic, we both hate ticks. Cannot stand them. Do not put Mary and Molly Shannon anywhere near ticks. No way. My dad and Mary and I picked up Mr. O'Neill for church every Sunday, and afterward we'd go to Sands Delicatessen for breakfast. This tall, lanky man named John Goulet worked behind the deli counter cutting corned beef. He had the voice of a professional broadcaster and was so friendly and talkative, saying hello to everyone. We would always stop and say hi. Mr. O'Neill and my dad would always split an order of eggs and hash. Once a year, Mr. O'Neill would go all out and have us over for dinner. Roast beef, mashed potatoes, Brussels sprouts, sugar cookies from Huff Bakery. He would do everything when he cooked for Jim and the girls. We were like family to him. Mr. O'Neill was also an occasional blackout drunk. He was almost always sober, but once in a while he would go on benders that would last for days. He wouldn't drink for a year, and then he'd slip. On one of these benders, he passed out against a store's plate glass window, shattered the whole thing, and got arrested. The shop owner was furious, and Bill had to pay to get the window replaced. Things like that happened to Bill, my dad said. Once he started drinking, he couldn't stop. On vacation, Mr. O'Neill would go swimming, but fail to get past the breakers and flail around in the waves. Mary and I thought it was so funny. One time in West Palm Beach, where we were staying at the Holiday Inn, he started drinking, disappeared, and then showed up at breakfast the next morning, sloshed. When the waiter came over, Mr. O'Neill turned to my dad and said, "Jim, may I order a bourbon, please?" asking permission, while the waiter stood there. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. My dad said, "Bill!" He was really frustrated with him. Sometimes they would get in a disagreement and wouldn't speak for months, and then they'd make up. Mr. O'Neill went on benders much more often when we were on vacation. My dad was always taking us to school, cooking dinner, picking us up, taking us to ballet and piano. He would be completely stone sober all week, or even weeks in a row. But then if there was a party, he was the kind of person who would start drinking for the night and not know when to stop. If he got stressed out about bills, in the red, he would say, he might mix a vodka and tonic while he went through them. Smirnoff was the brand he liked. And when I heard that fork clicking against the sides of a glass, that stirring sound, clink, 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 I thought, oh no, it would make my heart sink. At parties, my sister and I would sneak up and sip from his glass. He'd try to hide his drinking from us. He'd pretend he was having just a plain Coke or just a plain soda, but we were suspicious he might have slipped something else in there. We were always anxious and worried. We were always checking. We could never just relax at a party with the other kids and play. "Go sip his drink," we'd tell each other. And if it tasted like vodka, ugh. Of course, it wasn't just parties. Once a year, he would go downtown and have lunch with his friend Don O'Malley. Mary and I hated those Don O'Malley lunches. Our dad usually didn't drink during the day, but when he had lunch with O'Malley, he would have a few pops. I remember once we were watching The Little Rascals after school, and he called to check in on us. I answered, and he said, Mary? Molly? He wasn't sure who it was. "Sweetheart, how are you doing?" I covered the receiver and told my sister, "He's slurring his words on the phone." Mary whispered, "Is he drunk?" I whispered, "Yeah, he's drunk." We gave each other looks that said, "Oh, it's so disappointing. It's so heartbreaking." It was the afternoon. But it was so great we had each other in these moments. My dad's inner circle was made up of Jolene Ranft, Ann's mom, who was thoughtful but also gullible, Dick Sullivan, a very tall, very handsome guy, Francis J. Talty, sloped shoulders, tight smile, a big judge in Cleveland, and Poppy Hawley, this tiny, sexy, preppy divorcee with a beautiful daughter in high school. Poppy was literally always drunk. She would be in her cute little tennis clothes looking adorable, drunk. But she was part of the gang. Once I blurted out to her, "Oh my God, your legs are so skinny." "Yes," she said. "I have very skinny legs, but they work like two thick legs." And when this gang came over, they stayed over and drank all night long. Together, they would all get rip-roaring drunk. Judge Talty was always addressed as Judge Talty. Along with my dad, he was the ringleader in staging what they called Catholic scenes. "Listen, Dick," he'd say to Mr. Sullivan, "you be the bishop and I'll be the pope." Then he said, I absolve you, Father, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And then they all laughed wildly. Poppy just shook her head and said, you boys are crazy. And they were crazy. Ann Ramp once caught my dad making out with her mom in their basement, and we got so excited. Maybe they'll get married and we can be sisters. Sometimes my dad would wake me by calling upstairs, Molly, come down and play the piano. So I would come down in my nightgown at 4 a.m. Woohoo! They would all be shouting, a bunch of cheering drunks dressed up as the Pope and his bishops. I played them one of the songs I was practicing in piano, Climbing. They applauded, I curtsied, I went back up to bed, and then the sun would be rising. But they would still be at the house. They'd order a platter from their friend John Goulet, the counterman at Sands Deli. He would always hook them up with a giant cold-cut platter at the best price. Then they would all sit on the porch continuing their party. Anne would call and ask, are the drunks at your house? Yeah, I'd say. The drunks are here. Her mom was with them, so Anne and I bonded over it. Mrs. Ramph was not as big a drinker as the others, but she could keep up. Then come over to my house. Get the cereal box and come over. I'd grab a box of Quisp, get dressed, walk across the neighborhood, and have breakfast with Anne to get away from those wild adults. Another one of my best friends was my neighbor, Wendy Foy. My dad had a crush on Mrs. Foy, who was this gorgeous, really young mom who looked like Naomi Campbell. Shaker Heights was a racially mixed neighborhood, especially my street, Winchell Road, which was truly half black and half white. There were 5 Foy girls, all of them natural beauties. I would sleep at their house a lot. The Foy girls all loved my dad because he was so silly. We had a Dodge Dart Swinger, and my dad would take the car out and imitate the bad driving of the woman who rented the first floor below us, one of my dad's tenants, Sally something. Stopping, starting, stalling all over the neighborhood in our convertible, they would die laughing. The Foy girls screaming and shouting, Mr. Shannon, do it again. He would do full dramatic imitations of this nervous driver. They thought my dad was the funniest, and my dad loved making them laugh and doing his impressions. I liked staying up all night with the Foy girls. We would listen to Touch Me in the Morning by Diana Ross, and the older sisters would smoke cigarettes, and we'd all stay awake until the sun came up. At dawn, Wendy and I would push our baby dolls around the block in strollers and look at the maggots in the trash cans. She was a great friend. Once when my sister and I were both at sleepovers, our dad went out and drank too much at the Pewter Mug, got a DUI, and was thrown in jail for the night. He raised hell in jail. He took his cane and raked it across the bars and yelled and really created a scene. Another time when I was in 6th grade, I slept over Saturday night at my friend Amy Wall's house, and Mrs. Wall had to break the news to me Sunday morning. Oh, your dad's not good. He'd been in another car accident. So Mrs. Wall let me stay at her house all day to let him rest. I didn't get home until 9 at night. When I walked in, I went up to his bed. He looked so sad. I cried a little. I was really worried. I had a lump in my throat. He was wearing a big bandage on his chin. Some of his teeth had been knocked out again, and his chin had been cut deeply. It was really scary, and I felt bad for him. Oh, how could this happen again? My dad knew he had to try to get sober. He really wanted to be a better person. When I was 12, he gave up drinking for the first time in a serious way. He started going to these super Catholic Alcoholics Anonymous retreats. But then the downside was he would get too Catholic-y. We would be waiting in the car for takeout, and before he would run in to get the food, he would say, "Listen, while you girls wait, see how many Hail Marys you and Mary can say before I get back." Usually we would both laugh and think, oh my God, it's just too religious. We're not going to say Hail Marys while we wait for our hamburgers at Manners. But sometimes we would have to say the Hail Marys. Then at night, he would kneel down on the floor by the side of his bed and say his prayers. There was a big, beautiful framed photo of my mom in her wedding dress on his nightstand with a rosary draped across it and the mass card from her funeral. He was always working his AA recovery program, trying not to drink, avoiding selfishness, seeing the best in people. He would write notes in the back of his small, black Alcoholics Anonymous prayer book to encourage himself. He filled them with little motivational aphorisms. One day at a time, make the most of this day, No name dropping, no gossip. Listen to others with interest. Concentrate on what they are saying. Don't try to impress people. Keep your mouth shut. Do not criticize others. Respect all as they are. Be humble. Think of all the favors others have done for you. Listen. Pay attention to others. Listen. He would meditate on that stuff daily. But when he got asked to lead AA meetings, he would be nervous, so I would coach him. Just tell the truth, you know, tell your story. It will be good. Oh, Molly, thank you. We went to Mass every Sunday at St. Dominic's. Mary and I would sit in our pew behind the perfect little Catholic families with a mommy and a daddy and all their kids dressed in their Sunday best. I would study the way the moms would act with their daughters. One time during Mass, to make Mary laugh, I imitated one of those perfect moms and pretended Mary was my little daughter. I lovingly stroked Mary's shoulder-length brown hair. Then I put her hair behind her ear and I said, "Oh, darling, you look so pretty. You should wear your hair like that all the time, behind your ears," pretending to be her doting mother. Mary was cracking up. She thought it was so funny. Then, playing along, she started doing it to me. "Oh, honey bun, your hair looks so nice. You should pull your hair back like that." She would do it to me, and I would do it to her, and we would pretend to be each other's mother. It was so relaxing and silly, and it felt so good. Church games, little church games. When my dad met a stranger he liked, he took an interest in who they were. He used to pick up hitchhikers all the time. There were a lot of drifters in 70s Ohio, and we got to know as many of them as we could. He didn't judge them. He would always give it up for anyone who had skills or experiences that he didn't have. And people would really open up to my dad. Adults at cocktail parties, my friends. He was genuinely interested in everyone and remembered names and asked questions and took notes. He was adorable, so cute and funny. He really liked people, especially intelligent people. He was moved by intellect, always wanting to learn something he didn't know. And he was also very emotional. When I would say, "Daddy, I love you," he would mouth back, "No, I," pointing to himself, "love you," pointing to me, and then he would get all choked up. And if something was really touching to him, he would always be fighting back tears. He had a very big heart, and when he would lose his temper, he would feel remorse. My friends never felt judged by him. They would open up to him in a way that they didn't with their own parents because he was so easygoing and open-minded, and he had an alternative view of things. You could tell him anything without feeling judged. He was genuinely interested in what you had to say. He would always ask them questions about themselves.